I'm your host, Eddie Webb, and with me we have Dixie.
Hello.
And Matthew.
Hello there.
And we are going to be interviewing Danielle Lazon. She's a lot of our people bring on, they've done everything, it seems. Particularly, she's been working on Vampire Requiem. She's a new Requiem line developer. She was very influential in working on the Trinity core book for the Continuum and helping StoryPath get to the point where it is now. And she also works as the line developer for 7C over at John Wick. So she's done a ton. And I'm really curious to see kind of what she talks about, because she's one of those people that she worked very hard behind the scenes for a number of years, and then her career kind of just suddenly took off. So I'll be curious to talk about that transition of what it's like to go from trying to scrape work together to what it's turning down work.
Well, yeah, because from what I understand too, she had a whole career before she started doing this, like a whole completely different career. Kind of like when we talked to Megan Fitzgerald, it's like she works for NASA, she's an archivist. Like, Danielle has a whole background in the sciences that you wouldn't think would transition to someone being an RPG developer. So
yeah, absolutely. And it's she's one of those people that's actually gone full time now, like yeah. Most of us have full time contractors. So I'd be curious to talk to her about that.
Well,
Matthews or anything?
Yeah, for me, I guess being a company man, my main interest is Requiem, her vision for it, her thoughts on it, how she's found developing it, because she's still, I guess, fairly new to developing the line and inheriting it from Rose Bailey. And yeah, I'm going to be very interested to hear what she has to say about what her thoughts are on Requiem Second Edition and her plans for that game line.
Okay, cool. Well, as is tradition, one of us is banished from the interview. In this case, Matthew has drawn the short straw, so he will be kicked unceremoniously out of the podcast at this point.
You guys,
it's fine. I didn't want to be here anyway.
You guys realize that I'm the only person that's been in every interview so far.
That is true.
When do I get a day off?
you're the secret power behind the throne.
Yeah, that wasn't ever part of the plan. How have you gripped onto power so tightly?
I have no idea. Just every time we go to schedule an interview, it's like, okay, it'll be you and Eddie. Okay, it'll be you and Matthew. I'm like, all right, that's fine. I'm here.
Well, what if we'll change that then. You won't be invited to the next few podcasts.
Oh no.
Got to make up the numbers. they don't even have to be interviews, to be honest.
We'll just randomly remove you from podcast now.
Yeah, for purposes of equanimity, this will be the Eddie and Matthew show.
What you should do is just remove my vocal track so that it's just you two talking to each other, but there's these weird gaps and then you answer. That can
right.
be fun.
It's like pause.
was that you trying to laugh like Matthew?
Yes.
No. Very good, yeah. Anyway, better get on with this interview.
On that amazing note, we're going to go ahead and go and start talking to Daniel.
Have fun. Danielle. And if he turns up, Daniel too.
Yes. Hello, it's Eddie, and I'm here with Dixie.
Hello.
And we are both here with Danielle Lauzon. She has worked only for a few years at Onyx Path, but she's worked on Vampire, Demon, Mage, Beasts, Werewolf 20, V20 Dark Ages. She's worked for Ninja Crusade, for Chill, for 7th C, just everything in the world. So, welcome, Danielle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I think you've probably best known right now to Onyx Path, because you're the new Requiem line developer. You kind of inherited that from Rose recently.
That's correct. That is my current, I guess you could say, full-time position at Onyx Path. Like, even though, you know, I'm just a freelancer and don't have a full-time position.
Right. Exactly. That's kind of your more persistent position.
Right.
How's that been? Because I know Rose has put a firm stamp on Requiem. What's it been like kind of transitioning into the Requiem world?
Actually, it's been really nice. The first couple of books that I developed for Requiem, I did alongside Rose. And so she was able to give me some really strong direction and some really good kind of, you know, she's had a really firm imprint on Requiem. And the best thing about that is that I really like the things she did with Requiem. And so instead of kind of wanting to put my own footprint or my own mark on it. Instead, I just kind of want to carry what she's done forward and continue with the awesome direction that she put Requiem into.
It's been more kind of just implementing what's already been laid down rather than necessarily putting your own stamp on it.
A little bit. I mean, there's definitely some things that, you know, I personally, you know, everybody kind of likes different things about a game line in general, right? Mm. And so clearly whenever I'm writing an outline or I'm writing, developing a book, I'm going to put emphasis on the things I like the most and bring those out more. But I definitely think that there are things that, you know, Rose was already doing that I also already like. And so it's not going to be like a huge change of tone or a huge change of focus, just because I feel like my direction was already in line with what she was already doing.
Right. Yeah. And from what I remember of the process, sometimes when we have a transition developers, it's very kind of start finish. You know, the other person stops working on projects and the person picks up the projects. But with Rose, I recall it was much more of almost like a mentorship where she spent a lot of time working with you on projects before she's eventually phased out.
Yeah, both for A Thousand Years of Night and Half Damned, which are both already out. Rose worked with me on those outlines and with the development of those books, kind of as a mentorship and just in general, like brainstorming things, even for the outlines for, say, Guide to the Night or Spill Blood. She, you know, kind of went with me over those outlines and the direction I wanted to take them in and gave me feedback and things like that. So yeah, it was definitely more of a mentorship and more of a kind of a training and handing over gradually of the materials rather than just like, well, here's everything, do what you can.
Right. Here you go, sucker.
Yeah, right.
So I'm curious, what are those things that you like about Requiem the most that you're kind of focusing on or bringing in more?
Sure. So for me, Requiem has always been a very sexy game. And I think that, you know, Rose will agree with me on that. She may have her own opinions on what that means, but I think Requiem is one of those games where, you know, for a while it struggled with an identity with what is Requiem versus Masquerade.
Right.
And Rose in the second edition really took what Requiem could be, which is this very personal horror, but also just kind of a very sleek and sexy game about being tragic individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And turn that into a game, and I really enjoy the kind of give and take between going out and using your vampiric superpowers, as it were, and having that essentially create constant conflict in your life, because the things you do bring pain to those you love around you, and you cannot help that from happening. And so dealing with those consequences and dealing with those ideals while still trying to, you know, solve problems and inherently trying to be a good person and often failing at that.
Right.
And what does it mean to be a good person and still do good in the world, and being a bad person and still doing good in the world? And so all of those things kind of are things I really like about Requiem that I feel like make it a unique vampire game that are different from other vampire games.
That makes sense.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Even like a certain difference from Vampire the Masquerade, you say.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of people don't really see the difference between Requiem and Masquerade as this kind of like tone difference, but there's huge tone difference between the two games. And then there's, you know, there are other vampire games out in the world, and they also have a different focus on what is it you do when you're playing a vampire. And so I like Requiem's what is it you do? Well, what you do is you try to live this beautifully tragic life.
No, I could certainly see that. And it's been interesting from outside perspective seeing this transition, because it has been so seamless. Whereas in the past, you can almost kind of see this is Will Hindmarch's era of Requiem. This is Joe Carricker's era of Requiem. Mm-hmm. And there's it's subtle shifts, but there's definitely a change in focus. You definitely see, like, you see more of the crime grit in Will's work, in Joe's. Joe, I think, is probably one more of the sexiness into Requiem. But still, you know, very specific focus. And then Rose kind of took those pieces and blended them together. And so it's exciting to see such a seamless transition, because it is rare. I mean, you know, when people talk about Masquerade or classic World of Darkness, there are kind of distinct eras in game lines depending on who's the developer.
Absolutely.
And so seeing something that's so seamless is very interesting.
Yeah.
Speaking of kind of easing into somebody else's vision, to talk about other companies for a second, you've had a similar experience, I guess, on 7C as well, right?
Oh boy, yeah.
Because John Wick has a very specific vision for 7C.
He absolutely does. Yeah, it's been very interesting in general, taking over as kind of the content developer of 7C. You know, I am now the line developer of 7C, the way I'm the line developer of Requiem, right? Outlines go through me, I approve them. I don't do as much direct development. Now, instead, I give kind of that higher level role of feedback to developers and help them out with things and coordinate the way books come together. But I'm also very much the person who approves the content and makes sure that the vision of the 7C remains true to its original vision. And that vision originally, I mean, it's not that it's not my vision in the sense that, like, I don't agree with it, but I am not the one who came up with it, right? That is John Wick's dream baby. And he put it into a book for second edition, and he has a lot of very specific desires for what the line will look like. And I have to kind of translate that and kind of keep in tune with what I think that he wants so that we can keep it as true to his original vision as possible while still being the one who's in charge.
Yeah, and that's a tricky balance. I know I had a kind of equivalent situation with V20, because rather than one person's vision, I had a committee of people at CCP who were all like, we need a Vampire the Masquerade to do X, Y, and Z for business plans, personal reasons, creative reasons, whatever. And so you're kind of in that interesting position of you have to implement an existing vision, but also you have to buy into that. You have to, on some level, agree with that vision be able to kind of almost instinctively implement it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It's very interesting because I've had a lot of talks with John about 7C, and, you know, there's some unanswered questions inherent in the setting of 7C, like, you know, there's this mysterious ancient race, the Sirene, who, you know, came before. And who are they and what are they? Right. And I have an answer in my head as to who and what they are. And that colors how I talk, like how I let people talk about them. And so that needs to be consistent through every iteration of, well, we talk about them in very vague terms. But when somebody knows the answer, even if we never tell the audience the answer, somebody should know the answer. And so it's a conversation I had with John where I was like, do we have an answer to this? Because we need one.
Right.
Even if it's a certain amount of, you know, what are not possible answers, you know?
Right. Yeah. And we did that too. We were like, well, what is it not? And, you know, John is like, well, it's not aliens. And I'm like, well, I'm agreed.
Oh man, I was really hoping for 7C ancient aliens, like all the conspiracy theorists with weird hair are just coming out.
Discovery Channel aliens.
I'm pretty sure that's going to be a Houses of the Blooded thing. It's not 7C though, but
yeah, we love you, John. let me kind of roll back. We kind of dived in right away to the developer stuff. Sure. Hold on, take a step back, just because that's my personal interest. But how did you get started working in the tabletop RPG industry? Because your career path definitely was not that direction. You have a master's in animal science.
Yes.
Right?
So, wow, it's a really, you know, I never think that my story is interesting when it was like much younger, and I was like, I meet all these professors or people who's like, you know, when I was working in Dallas, my the like professor over the lab that I had had a he didn't have a PhD in human medicine at all, even though he was running a giant neuroscience lab. He actually was a veterinary, like he had a doctorate of veterinary medicine. He worked on large animals for a long time, horses mm-hmm. and like cattle and stuff like that. And then he decided to do a postdoc in neuroscience. He did that. And then now he's running a lab with a bunch of like 20 people under him and all these grants and stuff. And I'm like, wow, how do you go from like being a veterinarian to being a professor at a, you know, at a major university, like researching neuroscience? I'm like, this is so weird to me. But my, mm-hmm. my own path has kind of done this weird, like, you know, circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. So, I have a master's in animal nutrition, and I was working on a PhD when my mom got very, very sick. And she had already been sick for a while, but she was on a steep decline, and we knew it. So I quit my PhD program and spent like the last 2 weeks of her life at home with her, taking care of her. And mm-hmm. after that, I was kind of like adrift, because I knew I didn't want to go back to my PhD program. In case anybody's ever considering to get a PhD, don't do it. it's really hard. And so it was like the worst, like the worst year of my life was working on that PhD. And I'm so glad it's over. I have no desire to go back to it. And so I kind of was adrift. I was like, well, what do I do? And things weren't great at home. And so I decided to move in with my then boyfriend in Dallas. And so I moved not across the country, but, you know, across the South from Alabama to Texas. And right. and when I did that, I was like, well, I've always wanted to write. I've never, like, that's a thing I've always done. Like, I write down my dreams. I write down stories. I have like 10 different first three chapters of a novel started
right.
like,
yeah.
that are all pretty awful because I didn't know anything about outlining or anything like that when I was doing that kind of stuff. But, you know, I've always enjoyed writing. So I was like, well, maybe I'll try writing stuff. And then, you know, if that doesn't work out, I'll get a real job. And so I spent the summer simultaneously trying to figure out how you break into getting writing gigs and also looking for a real job. And
right.
It was actually Matthew McFarland had posted on LiveJournal, and he was looking.
Oh,
for,
back in those days.
Oh yeah, back in those days. This was like 2008, right? So he posts on LiveJournal that he's looking for new authors, essentially people he's never worked with before, people who've never worked in the industry before, to work on a mage book. And I was like, hey, you know, I've written a master's thesis. and I emailed him that.
It's basically the same thing.
Yeah, I emailed him that. I was like, hi, I've never done any like fiction work, but I wrote a master's thesis. Can I send you something? And he's like, well, why don't you write up like a sample? And I was like, I can do that. And so I agonized over what to send, and I eventually sent something. And he was like, this looks pretty good. Why don't, you know, well, I'll hire you. And I was just like, wow. That was far easier than I thought it would be. and so, you know, I wrote on Magey Awakening, the first Night Horrors book, Unbidden. And that went over well. And then he hired me again for the Chronicler's Guide. And then I stopped hearing from him. And I was like, well, okay, you know, there's only so many books to write. And then he sent me an email after Gen Con that year. So it was, I guess, 2009. When CCP decided that they were done with books. And he sent me an email, and he's like, look, because I sent an email like that was like, hey, I haven't heard from you in a while, and I was wondering if you had more work, because I'm like hungry for this work. And he's like, well, I don't, because of this thing that got announced at Gen Con. And I was like, oh, well, that's cool. If you ever do anything on your own, let me know.
Right.
Like, I don't know anybody else. And sure enough, for the next couple of years, I didn't do anything. I tried to write some short stories. They like couldn't get them published anywhere. I just kind of like held on to myself. Like, I will jump at an opportunity if I see it, but I didn't know how to find opportunities at that time. And I definitely didn't know how to network. So Matt contacted me again for when he was doing the God Machine Chronicle and was like, hey, you know, do you want to get in on this? And I was like, oh gosh, yes. in not such nice, pleasant terms.
And, hell yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, I got really excited. And then from there, you know, now, oh, Onyx Path is a thing. And, you know, Rich is actually dedicated to making books again. You know, I did a few more things with Matthew. And then David Brookshaw was working on Mage. And he was like, oh, man, you know, you worked on Mage when it was still in a White Wolf property with CCP. And so do you want to work on New Mage? And I was like, well, yes. And then it just kind of like snowballed from there, where other developers started hiring me, and I wasn't just working for one developer. And yep. That's kind of how we kind work. Of, yeah, right. And I was like,
we just all tell each other, like, oh, this person did good work on this, you should hire them for something else. Like,
right. And that's what really, like, once that started happening, I started to be more like, I started to meet more people and kind of network better. And then, you know, and then somebody recommends me to, say, Aloy, who then hires me to work on Ninja Crusade, and now, and then now again on Part-Time Gods. And then I met Mark Diaz Truman at like a convention, and I had dinner with him and we chatted. And so when the JWP positions were opening up, he sent me like a message, and he was like, hey, are you applying? I think you really should. And I took that as like, I think they want to hire me, but I have to apply if they're going to do it. Right.
Yep.
Right.
And so I kind of, it, you know, and then it all snowballed. Right. And when I say it snowballed, like, that was, I guess that started in 2012. So it's been some years. It's been like six years of snowballing, but now, you know, I'm here.
That's so awesome. Mm-hmm. I always love hearing these stories, because like, everybody comes at it from a different place, it seems like. Like, there are, you know, some folks who come in here because they worked for White Wolf, you know, back in the day. And then there are some folks who were just really big fans and kept giving submissions. And there's people like Ian who, you know, just really wanted to, just really loved this one game and wanted to make it happen again. And it's like, it's really cool through the course of recording this podcast, like, hearing everyone's very different stories of how they showed up in the industry.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one thing that you're right. I love doing these interviews, is because there's not a standard path. It's always, everyone has their kind of own meandering way.
Yeah.
And one thing that you said that was really interesting to me is the value of networking.
Yes.
Because it is huge. When we are, the interview with Steffi Devan, she mentioned sometimes there's a frustration because she's in the Netherlands. It's harder to get that networking in because she has to do it remotely. She can't go to Gen Con or go to Origins or whatever as easily. So I'm curious, now that you've done it and you've seen how it works, what would you have gone back and told your younger self about how to network?
Yeah, so I would have said, save that $20 on business cards. like,
and see,
don't,
I have the opposite. Like, my business cards are what got me work.
See, for you, for an editor, I think that's true, but writers are a dime a dozen. Right. Like,
that makes sense.
You can go to like Gen Con and spit and hit a prospective writer. And so for me, the ways that I got my work was having like, have a drink with somebody, like have a sit down at a meal, like essentially talk to them in a personal setting, to where you make an impression and they not just think about you, but like the things you're saying, like the ideas that you have, demonstrate this kind of, you know, ability in that sense. And then if, you know, you send them a writing sample and it sucks, at least you've got a new friend.
Right. Yeah, or even if it just doesn't work for what they want, you know, like, it's not always, like, I know so many people that have submitted to us probably think that we hate their writing, and half the time it's not that we dislike the submissions, it's just that we have a ton of writers, and maybe it wasn't quite in line with what we wanted to do. Like,
like, every time I'm like, I want to bring in brand new people, well, I'm only going to bring in a couple of brand new people each time I write a book, and the reason is that I, like, it's harder to develop new people just because I need to be more firm with red lines, and I need to give more direction, and I need to do more handholding. And it's not on the fault of the new person, right? I want them to learn good habits, and so I want to take the time to teach them good habits. But that takes time and effort, and so I really only have enough time to spare for like maybe one or two people, train them well, and then release them into the writing world. And so I can't do a whole book of brand new people. So if I'm only, you know, I'm only producing two books a year for Requiem, and I'm only getting one or two new people each time, like I get like four new writers a year. Like that's it's not a lot.
Even though you might get 30 submissions a year or 40 submissions a year. We're doing the same thing with Exalted right now, because we are trying to put out more books. Mm-hmm. So we're you know, a lot of the Exalted books have like 20 writers on them because they're huge. And we're trying to bring in like three new people, maybe, you know, but that's it's the same thing where it's like you get this pool of 30 writers, and then you use 25 of them on one book, then you have no writers to work on another book at the same time. So,
And I mean, I have the benefit that, you know, I am both doing work for Onyx Path and for JWP. So I can bring in new writers from JWP into JWP. And we like to do small pieces for new writers. So like, we brought you in, here's this 3000 like fiction piece or setting piece.
Right.
3,000 words, write it. Oh, it looked great. All right, let's give you something bigger, 6,000 words, and kind of build them up to doing big pieces. And that's great, because if I train them that way at JWP, then I can be like, hey, I have this Requiem book I'm writing. Would you like to write 15,000 words for it? And they're often by that point like, oh, yes. And I know the style you want, and I know like the, you know, how to write well and things like that. And so I can kind of, I don't know if I'm allowed to be saying this, but I can kind of steal authors from other companies.
I think the entire RPG industry is such a weird mixed up pool of folks that work on everything. Like I know when I first came on at Onyx Path as a full-time freelancer, like there were people in the company that didn't know that I worked for Fantasy Flight, and I'm like, I work on all kinds of stuff. Like, right. I work for Darker Hue Studios, and I work Fantasy Flight, and I work for Seventh Sphere, and like, that's when I was in need of indexers recently, I wasn't, you know, going through LinkedIn. I was going to people like Adam Drury and going like, "Hey, do you know any indexers?"
Yes.
Right. So yeah,
and that's one thing that a lot of people I think miss, is because we're primarily an industry of contractors.
Yes.
So we're always working for each other and each other's business. I mean, you know, I mean, heck, we got Dennis Detlors doing some work for me on Monarchies of Mal. It's like, that's a connection that most people wouldn't see, but that's, he saw a thing and said, "Hey, that's cool. I want to help out with that." You know, I mean, that's a very common connectivity. So I mean, it's not really stealing, it's more just kind of spreading the work around, and you get to work with someone you're comfortable with, even though it's for a new company.
Right.
And also, I've found as a contractor that working with lots of companies means I learn a ton from each company. Each one does things a little differently.
Oh, yeah.
I can kind of bring that back to my own work.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually something that I've been, before I started working with JWP, and one of the reasons why I applied to work with JWP is because for the longest time, my stable of work, the most work I ever got was from Onyx Path. And I had a little bit of work from Third Eye Games and a little bit of work from Growling Door, and that was it. And I really wanted to go a little wider and like cast my net a little wider and work with other companies. You know, a little bit because I was, you know, there was the Paradox scare. There was uncertainty around what would happen with Paradox owning White Wolf and where are our jobs going to go? There was a little uncertainty there.
I was definitely editing when that happened, and I was like talking to Rose, like, "Am I still going to have work?"
Right. I mean, it was uncertain times, and that kind of showed me and told me, like, if that happens, right? Say Onyx Path falls apart because, you know, Paradox doesn't really want to license this thing to us anymore, and yes, Rich is working on things that don't belong to White Wolf, but there's only so much of that going around, and there's a lot of people who work for him that would be deeply hungry for work. And so I'm like, but I don't have other places to go to ask for work, extra work. Mm-hmm. And so I started to get a little like, I need to get out of my sweet spot, out of my comfort zone, and start moving myself out to other people. and I moved to JWP, and I haven't really gone from there. And I love JWP and I love Onyx Path, but I keep thinking to myself, oh man, you know, I should still cast my wide net so I can do a little bit of work with, you know, say maybe Posthuman Studios.
Yeah, you've always got to hustle.
Yeah, and I feel like I should be hustling, but I also don't have any time.
Right.
Yeah, no, I have the same problem right now where, like, I'm having to, I'm moving in a few weeks here, and I had actually, like, turned down some work recently because I was just like, if I keep taking all these freelance jobs, all I'm going to do
is... Turning down work is, like, the worst.
I hated it. It was hard. One of the first times I've ever had to do it, and I hated it, but it's one of those things where it's like, I start thinking about it, and I'm like, Dixie, you literally, like... You get up, you work for Onyx Path from, say, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever, like whatever time I block out for Onyx Path work, and then you spend your evenings and weekends working for other companies, but, like, you need to spend your evenings and weekends packing. Like, you've got to have a life.
It's weird because, like, I ran into a similar problem when I started moving into the video game work.
Right.
I reached a weird tipping point where I started to have too much work, and so... I was feeling nervous. I was like, oh, if I turn this down, I'll stop getting video game work. And so I had the brilliant solution of, I'll just raise my rates. I'll ask for a ludicrous amount of money. And they'll turn me down, and then I'll feel good about myself. Problem is,
I decided to pay you anyway.
And so it's like, well, crap. Now I'm stuck with this amazing rate of money. I really should do it.
I guess. If you're going to pay me in dump trucks of money, I guess I'll do it.
Well, to be fair, it was also like, it was a combination of that and also his Futurama at the time.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah, working on, I mean,
that's hard to turn down. So, you know,
I know, I didn't, I'm glad I didn't. I learned a ton on that.
My issue with Fantasy Flight is, like, I'll be sitting here and I'm like, I'm not going to take project from them for a little bit. And then they're like, do you want to work on Star Wars? And I'm like,
yes!
How do I say no to having my name in a Star Wars book? Like, I've been a Star Wars fan since I was an infant, because my mother is one.
So I want to spend a moment hijacking this interview to talk about turning down work. Definitely, like, you know, Eddie, you just said that, like, there's the stigma for contractors specifically where you think, if I turn down a job, if somebody says, hey, I want to hire you for this thing, and you're like, I don't have time, that they're never going to come back to you. And for anybody who's a writer and a contractor, as a person who hires them, that's not true.
Yeah, that's not
true. It doesn't matter
at all
that your brain tells you that, okay, but it's not true. If I ask you to write for me, and you have the wherewithal to be like, I'm too busy and I'll fail you if I accept this project, that's not a mark of, like, oh man, that person, I'm never going to hire them again. Instead, it's like, oh man, that person's responsible. And I respect them even more for being able to turn me down. And that just means that I'll offer them work again later. And hopefully they will have time for me. Sometimes I'm disappointed, but I've never been mad that somebody turned me down or decided, well, you know, you didn't have time that time, so I'm never going to hire you again.
Yeah.
Even though
I will say there's a caveat to that, though, because you're absolutely right. I've never said I'm never going to hire him again because they turned out work. But what happens is that because it happens so rarely, and we're all generally contractors, that sticks in your head. And so I've had conversations where I've been like, I can't do work for the next few months because I'm busy. And then I come back to him a year later and say, hey, you know, I'm free now. And say, oh, I figured you're too busy. It's like, no, I mean, it was just that time period. But because you did say you were too busy, and it's, again, so rare, like you say, it's people disproportionately believe how busy you are. And so I had to tell people, it's like, you know, I've been treating a lot of my clients. It's like, always, if you feel like I'm good for a project, reach out to me. I'll let you know if I'm busy. Don't assume I'm busy.
Yeah, I think.
Because a lot of times when I'm posting stuff online, there's like 5 projects went live. That's because that shit I did a year ago.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's definitely something I try to be aware of, because I guess I came from that atmosphere. So if I ask somebody to write for me or do a project and they're like, I don't have time right now, literally the very next project I have, I'm like, hey, what about now?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
It might be just a couple of months later, but they may be free now. And I really want that person specifically, their voice on this project. And so I guess that's advice to the people who hire people, like, don't assume people's busyness.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Totally. And I mean, that's the thing is, like, just because you turned down something once, like when I turned down a project recently, they came back to me immediately and were like, so when are you available? And I was like, probably after Gen Con, because that's kind of my my thing right now is I'm not taking any new work until after Gen Con, aside from Onyx Path stuff that I, you know, do all the time. But, yeah. Like, I'm not taking any other freelance work because I'm moving right before Gen Con. And so it's like, I want to move, I want to go to Gen Con, I want to have fun, I want to network, I want to do all that stuff. And then I can come back and take a deep breath and go, okay, now I have room on my plate for all this.
Yeah.
Right, and you have no clue who's busy and who's not. I'll dance around this a little bit, but there's a extremely prolific comic book writer that lives nearby in the same city I live in. He's a friend of mine, and he's always telling me about all the projects he's working on. So I was like, hey, I had a project. I was like, he's not going to be interested, but I'll reach out to him and see if he knows anybody who might be interested, you know, because he knows a million people in the industry. And he's like, I could do that. And she's like, what? Because he had a hole in his schedule.
Yeah.
And so I was like, that's super exciting. And I, if I hadn't asked, I wouldn't have known. So I mean, that's kind of the flip side of it is like, you know, as a contractor, being aware of what your schedule is and being able to project, like you said, okay, here's my date. Here's when I can take work again. Because a few times I've reached out to contractors and I've been like, you know, hey, I've worked for you. And say, well, I'm too busy right now. It's like, when will you be free? He's like, oh, I'm not sure. Well, then I don't know when to contact you back.
Right. Yeah.
If it's someone I really want to work with, I will just keep following up with them. Like you said, Danielle, but for a lot of companies there's, because you said you can't throw a rock and not hit a potential writer. So yeah. Sometimes it's just,
they fill that
okay,
space.
Well, I'll think of you later, but then the next 12 people who are exciting talents have already crossed my desk. Right. I'm going to focus on them now.
Right. My advice to the actual contractors or writers, artists, whatever you're working on is like, don't feel ashamed to turn down work, because I've seen it happen too many times where someone doesn't want to turn down work. So they keep taking work and then they're killing themselves and it's affecting their life or it's affecting their, you know, day job or whatever. Like I've had moments where I'm sitting there and I'm like, I have these four things to do and I don't know where I'm going to find time to do them. And then I'm working 12-hour days for like, you know, 2 weeks. And that's my own fault. And I've seen it happen to friends too, where like they keep taking work when they already have too much work.
You can't see me raising my hand, but I am.
No, I mean, I think almost everybody has done it at some point, because you start reaching out and you start going, oh, I want to do this job and I want to do this job and I really want to work on this project. It's like a pet project of mine. And then you turn around and you're like for me, I would turn around and be like, I have 500,000 words to edit in the next month now.
And
okay.
I don't think that people really take into account the how draining it is to do creative work. Like even just to edit, right? Where you're like, but you're reading, you're not just reading for comprehension, but you're reading for like a very specific task when editing, when developing, when writing, you know, you have to do all this like reading for research and then writing, and you know, you're using so much brain power that like, oh, I sat in front of my computer for 8 hours today and why do I feel like I'm dying?
Yeah.
Because you spent absolutely 8 hours actively using your brain for creative tasks. And honestly, people should only maybe be able to like produce a good 4 hours of that. And so if you force yourself to produce 8 hours of creative activity, like it's draining and it's not good. And so a lot of people forget that, like, you know, those 8 hour days that we hold ourselves to are really a construct of a business side of America. And I'm going to say America because I don't know about other countries, but a business side of America where workers go into an office and they're expected to be there for 8 hours or whatever, and they are productive for about 4 hours of those of that time. And people recognize that that's true, but they're there, they're on call. If somebody calls and needs an answer question, you know, a question answered, or they need a task performed, your workers are there to do it. And then when you're doing like service work, you're not doing a ton of thinking. So if you're like cleaning or making burgers or whatever, those are, I call them mindless tasks. Not that you don't have to be skilled to do them, but you don't use a lot of brain power to do them.
When I still do my work at Sephora, I mean, I'm listening to podcasts usually the whole time because I work before the store opens. So like, it doesn't take a lot of
my brain. Stocking shelves and things like that. Like I used to do these works in the lab where I'd be like, I'm doing an assay. And so I'd listen to music and podcasts and books on my phone because it's literally just add some, you know, pipette some stuff and add some stuff and then wait an hour, or not even wait an hour, but watch it for an hour, change color or this or that or the other, or even like, you know, I would do, I don't want to out myself as a person who worked with animals in labs, but I did. And sometimes we'd be like weighing an animal, and it's like, man, picking up an animal, putting it in a little scale, recording that number and putting it back in its cage, doing that 50 times is so mindless. And so, like, I'm listening to a book while I'm doing that. And so I could do that for 8 hours and I'd be tired physically, but not mentally.
Right. And you can go home and write, or you can go home and work on whatever else you want.
Right. I would go home and write. And now I'm like, well, you know, I used to work all day and then come home and write. And now when I work all day, I literally cannot write anymore.
Yeah, I'm done.
I used to work at both a comic shop and Sephora at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I literally had days where I would go into Sephora from 6 to 10, go to the comic shop from 11 to 7, and come home and edit. And I was fine to do that.
Yep.
Like, it didn't really bother me. I might only get 3 hours of editing done, but it's still 3 hours of editing that I was doing.
That's practically, and, like, my whole work day at home.
Yeah, three hours
of editing.
Right, but, like, the Sephora work and the comic book shop work just didn't take anything out of me. Like, the comic book shop work was 90% sitting around talking to my coworkers until, you know, a customer came in.
Right, and then you're talking to the customer.
Like, yeah, and you're just talking about D&D and comic books and stuff all day.
Yeah.
Like, this is nothing.
Right, and so I think a lot of people, specifically, you know, freelancers, people who do like we do, where we work from home, and this is my full-time job, I sometimes hold myself to ridiculous standards where I was like, you know, oh man, I got started on that podcast at 11 and that took an hour, and then I spent 4 hours editing, and then I really need to get some other stuff done, but I'm tired and I don't know why. It's like, because you had a full day of creative work. So it's weird.
Actually, one thing that really helped me when I started working at CCP and then other video game industries, I learned about agile methodology. Mm. And it's a method of software production. I'm not going to go into details of it, but one thing that came out of that is, for planning purposes, they assumed that for every 8-hour day, a person would have 5 to 6 productive hours. Because the rest of the time is being taken up with coffee breaks, meetings, socialization, going to the bathroom, lunch, whatever.
Right.
And then of that 5 to 6 hours, 75% of that time is generally when you'll get actual work. So mm-hmm. of that 5 to 6 hours, 4 to 5 are going to be, like you say, the actual work. And then it's like emails,
right?
Following up on other details, you know, finding problems. And so when I started working for myself, I started planning with that in mind. Is like, you know, I'm not going to sit down at 9 a.m. and get up at 5 p.m. and have done all writing all the time. It's just impossible.
Oh, God, no.
So I tried to kind of, like, okay, in the mornings, you know, especially when it was Ireland, was really helpful because most of the people, my clients weren't getting up until noon my time. So, like, the morning right. would be just, okay, get writing done. Mm-hmm. And then the afternoon would be all the business stuff.
Right.
And that worked really well. And so I've kind of kept that in mind since then. It's like, okay, you know, I have my administrative stuff. I do that. And then that leads me into my actual work. I do that for a few hours and I get up and do something else. It's not mindless per se, but it is, you know, it's like answering emails or checking the forums or whatever.
Yeah.
It's stuff that's still getting me work or sending emails out for clients and hustling. That's all quote unquote work, but it's not the same mental work as creating or editing or developing.
Yeah.
Speaking of editing, actually, and we're talking a little bit about how other companies do things, and since I have an interesting intersection, people talk about this. How much does it drive you crazy when random words are capitalized in a game?
I am, if anybody has read Changeling 20 or upcoming Wraith 20, and wants to blame somebody for the fact that court is no longer capitalized in Changeling and guild is no longer capitalized in Wraith, that's me. I hate looking at a sentence and seeing, you know, 7 of the 12 words in it capitalized for no reason. I get that there are important terms that should be capitalized. Mm-hmm. Like, I have no problem with capitalizing condition because we don't write condition every other sentence, you know?
Yeah.
But I do have a problem.
Well, when you get story path, that changes.
Yeah, there's a big difference in story path.
So
my own personal opinion on capitalization is I hate capitalization for emphasis. And that is a lot of the time Game terms want to be emphasized, and so they're capitalized. And instead, it's like, this is a game term. It's a vampire. We're going to talk about vampires all day long. We don't need to emphasize that, right? And it definitely doesn't need to be capitalized. And so there's a lot of other game terms that I think fall into that trap of, oh, but this is an important aspect of these characters or these things that you want to do in game. And I kind of hold to the truth of, do I think of this as a proper noun? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Is this an important person, place, or thing? Then let's capitalize it. So is it an organization? Yeah, let's capitalize it. Is it a thing of utmost importance, like the Holy Grail? Let's capitalize it. Is it a thing that we see all the time because, you know, we see them in every shopping window at the shopping mall? No, let's not capitalize
it. Well, yeah. I mean, if Eddie, if you had chosen to capitalize, you know, cat in Monarchies of Mao, I would have been like, no, we're not going to do that.
So actually interesting, when I wrote the first Pugmire story before I worked on the RPG, the editors work at the time, we were debating about capitalizing the phrase good dog.
Oh.
And the interesting debate was, I was for it because I was kind of going for that almost religious connotation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but...
You know, I'm a good man, I'm a good dog, blah, sure, blah. Yeah. And the editor at the time agreed with me. When I started doing the RPG, it gets really ugly really fast.
Yeah.
And so I want to keep man capitalized.
Right, because that's equivalent to God. That makes sense.
Right, exactly. Literally, it is a proper linguistic noun. Slot that God has.
Right, it's a proper noun.
Right. But good dog, I changed to lowercase because, you know, I just felt like it was, you're right, it was starting to get in the way. And as I work on new games, you know, stealthily sliding this over to Dystopia Rising. as I work on DR, I'm noticing, you know, there are certain terms that were capitalized. Raider is a good example. You know, there are these raider clans, and they're cannibals, and they go out and do things. But they also are legitimately raiders. That's what they do. They go into the settlements, they take their stuff, and they leave. So whether it needs capitalization or not, because there's no real non-person who raids that doesn't fall into this group.
Right.
So there really is a need to capitalize that term, to my mind.
No. Yeah, there's right. not.
And that was interesting because when I asked you to kind of work on DR, Danielle, yeah. partially because you have a ton of experience with Dystopia Rising, but also because you have experience with the story path system.
Yes.
And so that's why you and I had some conversations about topics like that. It's like, right. you know, where's the emphasis fall on these right. things?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just agreeing with you.
Okay. Well, I was going to actually mention psionics, actually, which mm-hmm. I find interesting, because you worked on Trinity.
Yes.
And you helped kind of the core book get out of an interesting situation. It was kind of it needed someone to really help pay attention and get that yeah. to where it needed to go. But one piece of that is that there are psionics in Aeon, and then there are psionics in D'Arc, but they're very different.
Yes.
And I remember you and I had a chat at Midwinter. We were, and specifically, it's like, okay, how much is this the same? Should I use the same mechanics? And you were just like, basically, just start from scratch. It's totally different. They have the same name, but they're very different.
Yes. Yeah.
Because there is a different emphasis. And that's one thing that's been interesting. And I'm curious what your thoughts are, because I came to StoryPath after you and Neil had started working on it, and you came in after Neil inherited mm-hmm. it. So it's been kind of almost a chain from that. But in each of those cases, Scion, Trinity, now DR, and they came, the emphasis of StoryPath does change a little bit. So I'm curious what your experience was like working with Neil, because Neil's still kind of coming out from a Scion specific perspective, even though he definitely was thinking of the Trinity, but he's still... His baby was Scion, so kind of coming from Scion perspective. So how much did you find you had to kind of tweak and adjust to address Trinity's needs?
So an interesting thing happened between story path for Scion and story path for Trinity. That was indeed when we were working on story path, it was trying to be as neutral as possible so that it could fit both Scion and Trinity. And so the initial rules that, you know, Neil got some people together, wrote those rules. He then took those and like changed them to be very Scion specific. He did some playtesting. He got like some feedback on, you know, how do these things work together. He made some adjustments and some changes. And then when it came over to Ready Trinity Needs Now rules, that story path system, instead of being the thing that was pre-Neil working on Scion, it was the Scion thing, because there were so many basic rules things that got kind of changed in playtesting and stuff like that. And Ian did a fantastic job of going through it and being like, but we need this for Trinity, and we need this for Trinity, and we need this for Trinity, and we don't really need those things from Scion. And he got writers to then write some stuff for that. And but we didn't, nobody wrote the mechanics part. We just kind of all wrote around like this big clunky internal document that's like, well, when you talk about this, talk about it this way, you know, things like that. And so, you know, people wrote around that, and I was like, okay, but we need this to look like rules that we can put in a game. And so I hired Tara Zuber, who is an amazing human. If you haven't worked with her, I suggest doing it. But she took that document, that internal like dinosaur, I'm going to call it, not because it was old, but because it was huge and lumbering. So she took that and she, you know, made it into the Trinity mechanics, and then we wound up tweaking it a bunch for, you know, various reasons and playtesting reasons and stuff like that. But it was interesting to see like the things we needed to address that Scion had not, that Trinity needed to, because Trinity needed some very like, Scion is a very narrative game, so is Trinity, but Trinity is less narrative. And so there were some narrative things that Scion was doing that I was like, oh, but we really actually need to know a little more finely grained than that. And so, you know, making those changes was interesting, right? As you say. And then deciding like, well, which of these, like we made some changes, so which of these Scion / Trinity fit better for, say, a game like They Came or a game like Dystopia Rising, right? Yep. which fits better? And like Scion really fit better, in my opinion, with They Came.
Yep.
Where Trinity really fit better with Dystopia Rising.
Absolutely.
And so, and I think we made some changes for Dystopia Rising that are very specific for Dystopia Rising, but I also think they're great changes, and maybe they don't need to be translated back to, say, Trinity or Scion, but another game moving forward may pull from Dystopia Rising's change on things.
Yeah, and that's what I thought was fascinating, because that's one of the reasons, well, one of the many reasons why I wanted you on DR. I mean, just also, I love your writing, and I think you're a fantastic designer.
I'm blushing.
And I think it's a skill that not a lot of people appreciate enough. But it was also useful for me because we're not in the realm of how Exalted was a very firm difference from the original Vampire game, for example. I mean, those are two extremely distinct systems, even though they kind of have a similar lineage. They're not really connected in any way. Whereas StoryPath is not GURPS, for example. It's not an identical system that gets reapplied to each game.
Right.
So each game, it's a bit like inventing the next iPhone. You're drawing from the previous version, and you're trying to find new things that make sense for this new version. And so there's going to be some natural evolution of the art, as it were. But sometimes it's specific to the game. Sometimes it's general, just quality of life improvement. I know with DR, you and I had talks, and I also had talks with some of the other, all the writer team, actually, about things like, okay, it needs to have resource, the feeling of resource management without actually counting beans. And that's something that's closer to Trinity than Scion, because Scion is, you know, you have whatever your godlike mantle demands you need. And that makes a ton of sense. Same with They Came. They Came from under the, from Deep to Sea is very much the, you're leaning into, okay, well, I'm playing the soldier character in the movie, so I actually have all the soldier bits that go with it.
Right.
Whereas Trinity's just I hate to use the term, but crunchier in the sense that it digs into detail a bit more because it's necessary for some of the things it's trying to do. And DR kind of goes even further than that. It's like, you know, I have to care about, okay, I'm stripping this car down for parts to get the items I need to make my ride go.
Right. And I mean, I'm going to say that, you know, there's nothing wrong with the word crunchy.
Okay, that's fair. Some people are reticent to it. But...
I mean, I think that, you know, we do a lot of talk. I'm just going to side tangent really quickly, where we talk a lot mm-hmm. about like the fiction versus like the crunch. And I think that if your crunch doesn't support your fiction, like if it doesn't inform the way you play the game, then it wasn't good crunch.
Thank you.
Right.
and so like your mechanics can be very detailed or they can be very rules light, but they should absolutely tell the player how to play this game. And when I say that, not just right. like how to roll dice, but like it should inform them what kind of characters you're playing and what your characters care about and how they do things in the game. So I think mechanics are very important personally.
Absolutely. And actually, since we're getting close to wrapping up, there is one more thing I want to touch on that kind of segues a little bit from that. One of the other things you and I have chatted about is the fact that you're starting to work on your own video game work now, specifically with Choice of Games.
Yes.
And I'm curious, well, first of all, to explain to people kind of what that process is like, but secondly, if you've learned anything from working on interactive fiction as opposed to tabletop RPGs.
Oh, man, that could be its own podcast. So I'll try to be brief. So Choice of Games is a very interesting like media source because it is both like novel writing, so you have to be able to outline a book and write a story and have like a story arc and all that kind of, you know, stuff. But interactive fiction is such a different beast. It is, and Choice of Games specifically, because it's not just interactive fiction, but it's also that interactive fiction is in itself a game. You right. are your the choices you make increase or decrease your stats, and then later, based on the earlier choices you make, your stat, like you test those stats to see like, well, mm-hmm. were you making choices that made you stronger? Well, now when you try to punch the thing, were you strong? Yes. Okay, you succeed. But if you were making all these like nerdy choices about being a good reader, and then you try to punch something, you're just going to fail at that because you weren't beefing yourself up. And so like yep. the choices you make earlier, don't just change the game as you move forward and have impact, but they make it a game. Right, you can see your character stat blocks. You can yep. know that the choice you just made changed your stats somehow, and you can try to make, you know, and a lot of the choices then, because you know that they're gonna change your stats, they have to kind of telegraph how the stats will change or which stat you may be using to make a thing happen. And so right. designing dialogues and questions and choices that both telegraph the intent, so what is it that you're going to be testing, also telegraph what, you know, stats may be using, so that's like way more difficult than it sounds.
It really is,
because they can't just be like, I use my strength stat to punch someone, right? Like you can't, they've got to be narrative and make sense, but they also need to mm-hmm. telegraph, right? And so it is a very, it was difficult, but not in a bad way. And one of the things that it taught me, one of the things that you have to do in Choice of Games is it makes no sense to just give a binary choice, right?
Right. Right.
You should always have at least three options to every choice that a player needs to make. And that has forced me to think about things in a non-yes-no kind of way, right? So either this happens...
Non-binary solutions.
Right, non-binary solutions. So either this happens or this happens. No. Instead, this happens but with consequences, or this happens with different consequences, and then this happens with, well, different consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of having this kind of thought process that is like this or this, it instead has taught me how to think about things that are like, well, I mean, somebody's asking you if you want to do a thing, right? And I mean, really, like, if you think about it, that's like, yes, I do, or no, I don't. But how do I give you three options for that question? And thinking...
And also, all of them have to be equally plausible.
Right. All of them have to be equally like none of them can be like, well, I would never do that. Why would I right. ever do that? Instead, it needs to be like, well, I would do that because it makes sense. And so there's a lot of, you know, do you want to do this? I mean, what I want to do is this instead. Or, I mean, I do want to do that, but I want to do it this way. Mm-hmm. Right? Like all these kinds of options that aren't just binary solutions. And that, I think, has been the best learning experience for me.
Absolutely. And I mean, I know when I worked with them as well, the other thing that they taught me was how to be more inclusive in terms of writing fiction. And they're very, the company overall is very great about like, you know, hey, this can read a certain way, this can, you know, kind of exclusionary. So just from a presentation standpoint, I learned a ton working with them about that specific aspect. But you're absolutely right. The actual, also the how to make choices, how to craft choices. I feel like I brought some of that back to my RPG design,
yes.
particularly in Pugmire. It's a case of like, okay, how can I make everything look like a possible player path?
Right. Right. Yeah. And when I think about designing a game or, you know, mechanics informing how you play the game, I now start yep. thinking about how do we ask players not to approach things in a do I kill it or not kind of way.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. How do we get them to approach with multiple options and all of them equally valid? And so it's really interesting to think about, and it's really it's like good brain noodling, right?
Absolutely. So we are running out of time, but if anyone online wanted to noodle your brain about any other topics, where would they
that
find you online?
That sounded terrible, Eddie.
Phrasing.
Never, phrasing. Ever use that phrase again.
I feel like we're at that level of our relationship where I can do accidental innuendo. And it'll be
fine. I mean, hey-o.
Okay, then let me rephrase and say, if people want to chat with you online about completely non-sexual innuendo topics, how would they do so?
Well, I have a Facebook account, and I'm a bit of a Luddite, so I don't have a website, and I really should just do that. But I'm on Facebook as Danielle Lozon Harper, and I also have an email, like a work email at JWP. So if you want to ping me at JWP and then like start a dialogue with me, that's perfectly fine. Which is just Danielle@JohnWickPresents.com. It's also easy to find on the 7th Sea website, like not hard at all. So
fantastic. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And this is fun. Your dogs are finally going on?
No, that's not.
I think okay.
I've got Dixie a siren on my end. Sorry. Okay. I had a truck earlier I had to mute for, and then I didn't mute for the siren. I'm sorry.
Well, then we should probably go before you get arrested.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Danielle. Definitely appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much for inviting me.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're back. And that was really very interesting. I mean, I didn't expect to dig into some of the stuff that we dug into, but it was really, really great to hear some of her thoughts on the transition for Requiem and what it's like being a contractor.
Yeah. I was going to... Sorry, Dixie.
We're just going to talk all over.
You guys spoke at the same time, so we're officially interrupting.
Yeah, this isn't an interruption. this is just grandstanding. I think what particularly resonated with me about the guest was her saying, talking about the terror of rejecting work as a freelancer, and I guess this would apply not just in our profession, but in any profession where you happen to be self-employed, when to say no to work because you're afraid that by turning it down you'll never be hired by that company again. But at the same time, you need to know that there's a limit to how much you can take and still be as creative and productive as you need to be without becoming utterly stressed. You know, we've seen it time and time again through people we know taking on projects, too many projects sometimes, and we've all been guilty of it. Out of fear or overconfidence, or just circumstances arise where it becomes that you cannot complete this contract to the best of your ability, and knowing when to stop, when to say no, is really quite a challenge. Something you have to balance quite delicately, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right that it's not just this industry to work in our obligatory wrestling reference. Wrestlers are also self-employed. All of them are contractors. And so if you get injured as a professional wrestler, there is that very real concern that, you know, you're not going to be wanted back once you've healed. And so I think it's equivalent to being a creative freelancer, is because if you're burned out, if you're having social or personal problems, if you just aren't able to do the quality of work, there's a very real concern that if you take a break that people aren't going to remember you when you come back and you're ready to work again.
Right. But I mean, I think, like we said during the episode, I mean, most companies where I have to turn down stuff have been really good about being like, so when will you be available? Or, right, you know, I can reach back out to them. And of course, like, so many of us see each other at conventions and stuff too, that maybe you turn down work, but then you see that person at Gen Con and they're like, hey, how you doing now? Because I got a project coming up. And then you can do it at that point, you know? So there's all kinds of ways that you can get past it. But like, I've definitely had times when I was first freelancing, especially when I took on way too many projects at once or way too short of deadlines. And I've, you know, damn near killed myself trying to edit like four books at one time. And you just can't do that to yourself on some level. You still got to have time for yourself and time for your social needs and, you know, to do something besides work.
The trick seems to be, as you say, we bump into each other at conventions and the like, and the trick seems to be staying connected in some capacity or other. And it's something I've juggled with, I guess, or struggled with, because recently I was away on holiday with my family, and when I go on holiday, I like to deactivate my social media, or at least the Facebook, to at the very least.
Quick side note, I didn't know that, and so my wife contacted me days after holiday and was like, what happened to Matthew? He disappeared from Facebook. And I was like, oh, that's right, he deactivates his Facebook. I had to tell her, but she was like, has something happened to him?
Did he unfriend me? Yeah, I blocked your wife as well. But
Michelle.
No, Michelle is lovely. But I'd like to do that because I like to break off contact. I want a bit of pleasant isolation for a while.
Right.
But then there's always a temptation, do I need to switch it back on? And these of all these social medias that we use now, of course, it can be quite addictive, it can be quite distracting. This is a topic for another day, I suppose, you know, that work-life balance, and whether indeed we consider social media or all of it life. God, no, this is going very deep down a rabbit hole we probably shouldn't explore in an epilogue to an interview episode, but now my mind is worried.
What is life?
What is the point? So that's how I'm going to... What is the whole point?
We're going to have a completely existential episode coming up soon where we just debate the nature of reality.
Yeah, did any of us study philosophy to any...
No.
I was in philosophy club in high school and I don't remember anything.
Well, that makes you the expert. I think we've all written or edited something about a philosopher at some point in the course of role-playing games, because of course RPGs, just like I found with Age of Empires 2 when I was a young teenager playing video games, are fantastic learning tools. So yeah, I've probably learned more about philosophy through playing role-playing games than I have through actually reading any actual philosophy.
Honestly, I think most of my knowledge of philosophy is from the Monty Python Philosopher Song.
Yeah, that's how I learned most of the names. Immanuel Kant is a real...
And in my head, I'm starting to sing it, and I realize I shouldn't say anything, because otherwise then we'll have to pay royalties. So,
right.
If you do it less than 30 seconds, it's actually...
That's right.
That's like how it works.
Really?
Yeah, you can play up to 30 seconds of like any song without having to pay royalties.
You know, I wondered how podcasts specifically were able to use outros from, you know, bands like Alice Cooper and the like, and I was sure they weren't going to be paying these musicians, and yeah, it's probably that. They're just doing a 10-second outro. Yep. Eddie, you need to do a 10-second Alice Cooper outro for this episode.
Or alternatively, I won't.
Excellent.
We have those two options available to us. It's true. I am the bastion of all that is evil. Speaking of all that, I'm actually going to wrap this episode up. Dixie, where can people contact you online?
You find me on Twitter at Dixie Cyanide. Dixie, like my first name, Cyanide like the poison. That goes for most social media, Onyx Path forums, what have you.
And Matthew?
I'm back on Facebook, baby. So Matthew Dawkins on there. Twitter, it's Clack Click Bang. YouTube and the Onyx Path Forum as the Gentleman Gamer.
And people can find me most any social media websites, Eddie Fate, EddyFate, or my website, eddyfate.com. You can find out more about us through the Onyx Path, theonyxpath.com. We also have all of our episodes up on our website. You can also find our episodes on iTunes, on Google Play, through Podbean. If you do go there, please leave us a review. If you love it, if you hate it, please let us know. We always want to do better, and we always appreciate that little spark in our day when someone says that they've been enjoying what we're doing. And with that, thank you very much, and always remember, many worlds, one podcast.